So, Scott Parkinson, you are not a reduced Shakespearean. You are a genuine, authentic, full-blown Shakespearean. You're about to go into, in just an hour and a half, a performance where in the title role of the Great Dane Hamlet in the acclaimed Writers' Theater production here in Glencoe, north of Chicago. Can I get you anything? Are you on vocal rest?
It's amazing. I am sort of living like a monk these days, I have to say. I'm watching my diet. I'm watching my hours of sleep. I'm making sure I get to the gym every day to steam for at least 20 minutes to half an hour.
This is what real actors must do.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, whatever it is, wherever you are. Thanks for subscribing, streaming, or downloading and listening to us on your computer or MP3 player. I'm Austin Titchener, one third of the Reduced Shakespeare Company, and you are listening to this week's Reduced Shakespeare Company podcast, number 309, The Unreduced Hamlet. Scott Parkinson is one of those great stage actors you've probably never heard of. He's a Joseph Jefferson Award winner and a multiple Jeff Award nominee here in Chicago, and has acted in many, many shows on and off Broadway and on national tours in over a dozen productions at the Goodman and Chicago Shakespeare Theaters, and is now playing Hamlet in an amazing production by the Writers' Theater in the Chicago suburb of Glencoe. Of course, I and many RSC fans are possibly, probably most familiar with the reduced, abridged version of Hamlet. So I was thrilled to talk to Scott about what it's like to take on the entire whole unabridged melancholy Dane.
Yeah, well, when you're doing something like this, I don't know how else to do it. I have to stay away from the alcohol because I allowed myself to have one drink on Monday night. I went out with some people. We did an event, if you can believe it, after five shows of doing Hamlet on the weekend.
Five shows in 48 hours of Hamlet.
Yes. Oh, my God. We did this Literature and the Law event on Monday where we did the closet scene and the nunnery scene. You know, easy little scenes to do on your day off. And after that, we all went out to a bar for a drink, and I actually had a drink. And I swear I felt it last night during the show. I just was like, I felt sluggish. So even just a little bit of alcohol can make such a difference.
And also, I mean, he didn't really do a controlled experiment. Next Monday, have an actual day off.
Yes.
Don't do a show and then have a drink and see whether that affects you more.
Right, exactly. Well, and alcohol is a depressant, I suppose, and Hamlet doesn't need to be any more depressed than he already is what I discovered. So, you know.
Well, I want to talk about how you approached Hamlet, the role.
Sure.
You know, we'll speak as men, as one Hamlet to another,
yes,
as you know.
Exactly, absolutely.
But we have a sordid history together. We first met when you were an intern at American Stage Festival. In 1990, am I getting the year right?
Something like that.
You don't want to age us. No, don't let's. But if you weren't a teenager, you were not very old.
No. Yeah, I think I may have still been a teenager.
You might have been, and you were already phenomenal. And you played Caliban, and with such authority and such command of the text, and we all
dressed
went
like an Oscar award, as I remember.
I believe you were. I believe gold unitards were the
go-to Caliban costume of the day.
Of the day, and Dee still takes great pleasure in having discovered you.
Yes.
But you've made quite a career for yourself, not just in Shakespeare, but in theater. You've had an amazing theatrical career from New England to New York, or did you come straight here to Chicago first?
I came to Chicago right after New Hampshire. I was not really ready for New York when I got out of college, and I had some friends who were going to come to Chicago, so I went to Chicago first, and I thought I was going to be here maybe 2 years or so, and ended up being here 12, and primarily worked a lot with Chicago Shakespeare. That was kind of the mainstay of my employment while I was here. And
well, they must have been thrilled to have you.
Well, it was, I mean, it was so much fun. I was so happy to get involved with them, and Shakespeare had always been kind of a passion of mine, so when I ended up doing shows with them a lot, I was very excited and did a lot of shows with writers here where we're doing Hamlet. And, and then about eight years ago, I headed out to New York and have been sort of doing regional stuff ever since then.
Well, so two questions. How does one get enamored and passionate about Shakespeare in New Hampshire?
Mm.
And then why did you end up staying? Did you like Chicago? Because I know we get a lot of actors who ask, should we go to New York? Should we go to Chicago? Should we go to L.A.? I always recommend Chicago, but why was it good for you?
Why was it good for me? It was good for me, I guess, because just the kind of work that I ended up falling into was so rewarding. And I guess in so many ways, like I said, I didn't feel ready for New York. And I look at my first 4 or 5 years in Chicago as almost an extension of my training. You know,
right.
In a way, it was like getting me more ready to be. And I was non-equity, I think, for the first 5 or 6 years that I was here. So I was mostly playing smaller things that,
sure,
where I could sort of sit back and absorb and watch what other people are doing and just learn. And,
uh-huh,
and so I just did so much learning those first few years, and I just kept learning and learning and wanted to stay. And then once things started to kick up to a different level for me here, the work that I was getting to do was so great, and all of my friends who were in New York, who I would talk about moving there, they were all envious of what I had here, and they would say, oh my God, you get to work all the time there. If you come to New York, you know, you have to leave town all the time, and the work is not as plentiful, and, you know, unless, of course, you get really, really lucky in New York and things skyrocket.
And you play a DA on Law & Order.
Yeah, exactly. And you get the series regular on Law & Order.
Right.
Yeah, exactly.
Or the perp of the week. Yeah, that'll go so far.
Right, exactly.
Mm-hmm.
So I just stayed, and I ended up staying until I finally couldn't anymore and had to give New York a shot, because that had been in my blood, in my consciousness to go and do for so long.
Well, it's always there. It always hangs there.
Yeah, you grow up. If you grow up being an actor, wanting to be an actor, New York is always a part of the trajectory, it seems, in this country. You can't really get away from it. But in terms of why I fell in love with Shakespeare in New Hampshire, that's a good question. I'm not sure how that happened, because I didn't initially. It took a while. I was resistant to it at first. I was really into, you know, Eugene O'Neill and Tennessee Williams and Arthur Miller. That was
But even so, that just marks you as a big, huge drama nerd.
Yeah. Oh, yes. I was absolutely a drama nerd, absolutely. I was the drama geek. I did all the shows in high school and everything. But Shakespeare, I actually didn't really fall in love with Shakespeare until I read Hamlet in the 11th grade, I think it was. And there was something about that character that just, I went, boom, I get this guy. He's me, you know, which I think so many people do when they first read him. They think they personalize him so much because he can be so many different things in a way.
Yeah, it's true. There is, it's one of those roles where you can't, you can see different ones, but you can't see a bad one. I mean, if the actor's invested.
Yeah. Uh-huh. You can see ones that are very cerebral and then others that are very emotional. You can go in so many different ways, and none of them seem to be wrong. Like, people will ask me, who's your favorite Hamlet that you've ever seen? And I say, well, on stage, I think it was probably Adrian Lester, who was at Hamlet and Peter Brook's production about 10 years ago. And then my favorite film version is probably David Tennant. And you couldn't have two more remarkably different Hamlets. Mm-hmm. I mean, they're completely different. But I loved both of them for very different reasons.
That's funny. I have a very soft spot in my heart, I think some people would say head, for Ethan Hawke's contemporary one. And the most exciting one I ever saw was one of my first ones. It was John Vicary, who played Scar, then went on to play Scar the original. And then we worked together on television. I was able to bring the program and say, dude, I'm sorry, but I look what I have.
Wow.
But then I saw that one of your co-stars, the guy, it was also Scar. This kind of a Shakespearean.
Yeah.
I mean, since The Lion King is Hamlet,
mm-hmm,
the story of Hamlet. So do you consider yourself a to be Hamlet or a not to be Hamlet?
Interesting. In the sense that my Hamlet would be what? More obsessed with life or death, or
active or let me think this over a little bit longer. Hour to think about what I'm going to do
what
here.
You mean.
I don't know, and I don't want to draw you into any conversation that's going to fuck you up tonight.
You know, I don't know. I mean,
it's good. You don't think you haven't reduced it.
He is tremendously active for somebody who's supposedly not active. He's always doing things. I mean, even things that, you know, even choosing not to do something in the play is a choice, is a sort of active decision.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think he throws himself with such abandon into things in a way, you know, the madness. And then in our production, the play within the play, he's actually taking a more active part in the play within the play in our production. So he kind of throws himself into these different roles in a way that I see as very active.
Mm-hmm.
But there's no question that he stops to sort of think about things a lot.
Yeah,
he can't really get away from that. But the feedback that I've gotten, at least, has been that I don't seem like a brooding sort of over in the corner terribly pensive Hamlet, that there does seem to be some energy in life to what I'm doing. And I guess that's good. I mean, I don't have a feeling either way in terms of what it should be. But
yeah, that is amazing. And I was going to say, it's not 1990 anymore, and you're not a teenager anymore, but you still have a very youthful, boyish aspect. Mm. So in that way, you know, you're sort of an ideal Hamlet because you are boyish but old enough to understand what's going on. Yeah. I mean, what was so amazed me about your performance was all the theatricality of Hamlet's, all of his role-playing in not only the play but in this production of the play, but then also the emotional investment that you just gave to every single line. And the Writers' Theatre is a very small venue. It forgives nothing.
Yeah, it sure doesn't.
You know, you've got to really have it, and you obviously so have it. It was just so amazing to watch. It's not just beautiful language. It's beautiful language being spoken by a real person in pain.
Yeah, that's interesting that you mentioned that. Yeah, I mean, it's not... I was actually surprised at how much pain I found him in. I think when I was thinking about the role over the last year, I was thinking of him sort of cerebral and sardonic and sarcastic. For a lot of the reasons that I like David Tennant's performance, which I think David Tennant is not afraid to make Hamlet a little bit unlikable. Like, sometimes I think you just want to slap Hamlet upside the head. You're like, he's so self-righteous.
Snap out of it.
Yeah, he's so self-righteous, and he's so like, this is the way people should be, and blah, blah, blah. And so my thinking was all very much kind of in that direction before we went into rehearsal. And then as I sort of got into the script and just sort of put myself in his shoes, I just kept feeling just this tremendous sort of sorrow and agony that he must be in for the whole play.
Yeah.
You know, to start off the play being in this place of, I want to die, but I'm too scared to die, and nothing has any meaning, and I don't know. There is this loss of innocence and this sadness that's permeates his soul very deeply, I think. And as I started to explore what the sort of backstory for all these relationships might be and why and how that causes him to take certain actions that he takes in the play, the answers that I kept coming up with were just deeper and deeper sort of painful ones. And so I guess that has sort of woven its way in.
This is Shelby Sessler from Columbia, South Carolina. You guys should have come and seen The Complete History of America Abridged at Town Theater in Columbia, South Carolina last weekend. You're listening to Reduced Shakespeare Podcast.
Where can you RSC the RSC? Next week, we begin our first national American tour of the Ultimate Christmas Show Abridged, taking it to Reston, Virginia, Charlotte, North Carolina, Fort Worth, Texas, St. Louis, Missouri, Anchorage, Alaska, and for 3 weeks, we'll be at the San Diego Repertory Theater in San Diego, California. As always, the very best way to stay up to date about all of our worldwide performance dates is to sign up for the Reduced Reader, our email newsletter. Go to ReducedShakespeare.com and click on the link to subscribe and check out our touring page for a specific box office venue and ticket information. And now back to my coffee shop chat with Scott Parkinson as we started to talk about how exactly one prepares to tackle such a mammoth role. So you knew you were going to play the part for a while.
I did.
How much time did you have? What do you do when you realize, holy shit, I'm going to play Hamlet? How do you start?
Well, actually, this is the second time I played him. I played him once before in a summer Shakespeare festival where we only did like 7 performances. It was an outdoor, under the stars, free to the public kind of thing.
And did you have a week's rehearsal or something?
Well, no, we had, it felt like it. I think we had about 6 weeks, but it was, you know, it was all non-equity company at the time. So it was evening rehearsals, 3 or 4 hours, catch-as-catch-can kind of rehearsal process. And I knew at that time, I knew on that show as well that I had about a year to prepare at that time. And that time I read every book, every article, I watched every video of Hamlet ever done. And I think by the time we got into rehearsals, I was like a deer in the headlights. There was so much information crammed into my skull. And this time I decided, and I also had about a year, actually almost a year and a half this time where I knew I was going to be doing it. And this time I decided to not do any of that, to just really focus on the script itself. And just kind of live with that and see what that kept saying to me and how that kept speaking to me. And in a dialogue with Michael Halberstam, the director, who would come to New York once a month or so. And so we would meet up and we would talk about the play and we would talk about ideas for for what we were thinking.
It's almost the most fun, those prelim, pre-rehearsal meetings.
Yes, as long as, you know, Michael agrees with what I want to do. When he doesn't, then I get angry. But so that was a lot of fun. And Michael gave me a lot of leeway in terms of interpretive things that would normally be in the director's realm. He allowed me a lot of discussion about that, which I appreciated in terms of, and when it came time to casting and things like that, he would always ask for my input on his decisions and things like that. So that was terrific to be allowed to be put into that.
And so you come in, I mean, you've had all the preliminary conversations, and then what happens, and presumably then you know the text and all those famous monologues, and some of the not quite so famous ones. Then what happens when you get into the room and you're working with the other actors? Do things change? I mean, are you thrown? It's like, holy shit, I was thinking about it this way, and now it's this.
Yeah, I think you do, to a certain extent. The example I can think of is working with Shannon Cochran, who plays Gertrude, who my thinking about Gertrude before going into it was very different from what Shannon ended up throwing at me. And I love so much what Shannon throws at me that I was like, okay, I found a way to incorporate that, and actually it's just made what I do in the play even deeper and better because she's just so terrific, you know.
Well, it's one of the few times that I've seen a production where I wanted to see more of Hamlet and Gertrude because you guys are both so strong, and it really felt like mother-daughter.
Yeah.
Mother-son, excuse me.
But sometimes mother-daughter.
Depends on the night. But yeah, I mean, it really felt like you saw her anguish as much as yours, which I thought was really fascinating. Both of you were clearly working this out. I mean, the two of you together were just phenomenal.
Oh, well, thank you. Yeah she had a real notion about how affectionate Gertrude has always been with Hamlet. And it actually kind of, once she started to talk to me about it, it made perfect sense, actually, with the way that I had been thinking about the character, but in terms of him being a little bit of a mama's boy, you know, a little bit too tightly held to mama's skirt, you know, all his life, and needing that back, you know, in the course of the play. So it actually ended up dovetailing very nicely into the way I'd been thinking about the character.
And so now that you're in the heat of the run, and it's been extended to the end of November, so congratulations on
that. Thank you.
What happens now in the run? How much do you get to play? How much do you discover?
It's a great question. I think I get to, without radically reinterpreting anything, unless I would have to talk to the director, I suppose, if I wanted to do that.
Suddenly the other actors are going, is he supposed to do that?
Doing, I mean, it's always the interesting thing with, you know, especially with a long run like this. I think we run almost 3 months all told, from first preview to closing. You want to find ways to keep it fresh, and you want to find ways to keep other actors on their toes and have other actors keep you on your toes but you also have a kind of structure or framework that you have to sort of basically stay within so that you don't mess people up. But I feel like I'm finding new things every night and new connections to things and new ways to sort of chart the journey. There, I wish I could think of a specific. I'm always bad at thinking of specifics. But there was something the other night where I thought, like, late in the play, I just had this moment where I went, oh, I need to layer that back in, like, in scene whatever, because that'll have a payoff here. And those, like, little things happen in the course of a long run.
Yeah.
You know, and as long as you don't get bored, which I can't see happening with this, because this is such a lifelong dream come true for me, and I'm loving it every night, you know, I think things will just keep getting deeper and more playful and more interesting.
What do you do in this small of a venue where the audience is on three sides? And the night we saw it, Dee and I saw it, for instance, we had some teenage girl coughing up a lung behind us, and then a phone went off right during your speech where you'd said, call me a villain.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, Jesus, how do you I mean, I know how we deal with it, but how do you
deal with it?
We deal with it by saying, are you fucking kidding me? And we take the person's phone and we stop the show, but you're not allowed to do that. Do you just ignore? You just turn the blinders on?
Maybe I should come up with, like, a blank verse version of that, that sentiment, and just sort of pull that one out whenever it happens. Yeah, I mean, this space takes Herculean powers of concentration, for sure. And I've been fairly lucky that nothing has been too disruptive. I did have one night it was inevitable. I had a cell phone go off during To Be or Not to Be.
Mm.
And I just, and what was wonderful is actually the audience's reaction to it. You heard, 100 people go, tisking and like looking at the person, because it's the famous speech. Everybody wants to hear it, of course. And
we all feel bad for you. That's the thing about an audience. We're in this together. We know how hard you're working up there. Not that you make it look hard, but we're invested in this. Right. And then this motherfucker.
Right. And I think that, the only thing I could do at that moment was pause, and I just held and I waited for it to stop, and then I kept going. So if it's something that's that bad, I will do it. One night we had a woman in the front row who was unwrapping something during the first scene, and a large portion of that scene was played right, like 2 feet away from where she was. And she was in a wheelchair, and I don't know if what she was doing was unwrapping medicine. I wanted to just snatch it out of her hand, but I was afraid. I thought, well, maybe it's medicine. Maybe I shouldn't do that. So at one point, I just walked over, and I put a hand on her hand, and I just said, please, because it was just through the entire scene.
Right.
It was, this unwrapping was going on. It was driving all of us crazy.
And how does she respond?
She did not, she stopped, I believe, from what I recall.
So she wasn't mortified, she wasn't...
Well, I don't know, I didn't keep looking at her for too long.
Right.
We had another guy who, they do this at theaters now where they sell candy during the intermission, which drives me crazy. We had one guy the other night who had an M&M wrapper, and he was, doing that a little bit of crinkling during the second act. But fortunately, during the play, within the play, we actually have a bit about unwrapping candies. So when that came up, and we had Rosencrantz and Guildenstern unwrapping candies during the play within the play, and we, of course, shoot him a look like, what are you doing? The guy was kind of quiet after that. I think he got the point from that. So
it is a great bit, and I'll give you this tip for free. You use it or don't use it, but next time somebody comes in with M&Ms, just grab it from him.
Yep.
And during the next monologue, during the next scene, just hand them out amongst the cast members as you're doing the scene.
Yeah, that's a good idea.
It's yours.
I think if I was doing a comedy, maybe. I mean, Michael's given me full license. Michael, the director, Halberstam, has said, stop them, do what you need to do. If they're interfering on what you're doing, find a way to... And maybe if it was a different play, that would be easier to do. But it's sort of hard to break the thing that's happening with Hamlet through this thing to go and deal with a problem like that. But
and it's not your job, this part in this play requires so much concentration, to be able to do anything at all, even so much as put your hand and say please.
Yeah.
I mean, it just shows remarkable powers of restraint.
The amazing thing is when they sort of talk to each other, thinking that we're not hearing them. That's the part that amazes me, I just think, I don't know if that comes from just people used to watching television and being, I don't know what it is, but we had, I think my favorite comment from the front row one night was, on a Saturday night, we have a 4 and an 8 o'clock show on Saturday, and the show runs about 3 hours, and we had a comment somewhere in the third hour, they'll all be dead by 7. That was probably the best thing I've heard. But, that's part of... I guess that's part of the fun of them being so close, too, is you do... They participate in a way that sometimes for the good, sometimes for the bad, they participate in a way you don't necessarily feel with other audiences.
Yeah.
There was also one night where in the mad scene I said something like... When I'm haranguing Ophelia and I say we will have, or I'm going on about you jig, you amble, you lisp. It hath made me mad, I said, and you hear, from the little old lady in the front row, two feet away from me, I'll say, which is always, that's always kind of fun.
Does it make this intimacy is lovely? Does it make you long for? Please, God, get me back on a big 700 seat proscenium stage.
Yes and no. I mean, I think one of the reasons that people we're hearing about this production that it's so clear. I'm following it. I'm not lost. And I think part of the reason for that, and hopefully that's true because what we're doing is we've clarified sort of the emotional journey and the stakes of the play as opposed to it being some kind of Mickey Mouse, we're going to spell it out to you, you're 2 years old.
Mm-hmm.
And I think part of the reason people are following it has to do with the intimacy of the space, because we don't have to declaim, we don't have to do Shakespeare, and we're just sort of allowed to talk it and mean it and really go actively after things in a small space and give nuances that you wouldn't be able to give in a larger space. And I think that I've really enjoyed that aspect of it. So I think it will be, when I have to be on a, you know, 600-seat theater again, having to do Shakespeare, it might be a little bit of a letdown, actually.
That's it for this week's Reduced Shakespeare Company podcast. It's rare to see such a great production of Hamlet, and rarer still to see it up close in such an intimate venue as the Writers' Theater. So if you have any chance to be in Chicago, please try to see Scott Parkinson as Hamlet, oh, and Tony winner Shannon Cochran as Gertrude before the show closes on November 25th, 2012. Send us your favorite Hamlets via email to feedback@reducedshakespeare.com. You can also post comments on many of our website pages, and you can post reviews on iTunes. You can interact with other fans at our website and our Reduced Shakespeare Company Facebook fan page. You can also become a subscriber to our YouTube channel or become a twit. Follow us on Twitter at Reduced. You can find easy links to all these social networks at our website, ReducedShakespeare.com. Thanks, as always, to webmaster Matt Rippey, both a borrower and a lender, Matthew Croak, music by John Weber and GarageBand. Our random fan shout-out this week goes to Cherie Whitney. No reason, it's just random. Special thanks to Shelby Sessler and to Scott Parkinson for talking to me right before a performance. And thanks very much to you for listening. I'm Austin Titchener, 309/927 of the Reduced Shakespeare Company.
Well, we have plenty of sleepers every night. I'm always amazed. I look out at them like, well, God bless you. It's dark and we're telling you a story. I get it.
This podcast is a production of the Reduced Shakespeare Company. Reducing expectations since 1981. Go to ReduceShakespeare.com for performance dates, actor bios, email newsletters, and so much less.
So much less. So much less.